Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On Friday morning, July 27th, Hubig's Pies, a century-old institution, tragically burned to the ground in New Orleans' Faubourg Marigny. Drew Ramsey's here with details about the loss of the bakery and how his company plans to rebuild, restore, and re-Hubig's. Then, Paul and Angela Knippel, authors of The World in a Skillet, take us on a food lover's tour of the new American South. But that's not where the traveling ends this week. Rambling reporter Ian McNulty reveals a secret spot for delicious seafood near the Louisiana-Arkansas border. We're making tracks on this week's Louisiana Eats. Since 1922, Hubig's Pies and their happy mascot, Savory Simon, have been Louisiana icons. Previously on Louisiana Eats, we sat down with Drew Ramsey to learn the history behind those little fried pies. So tell me, how did it all begin?
Well, there was a real man named Simon Hubig. He came from Europe at the turn of the previous century. It's widely believed that he got his start in baking, his interest in baking, because his mother worked at a bakery in Basque country, actually, literally 100 years ago. And when he came to America, he figured that he could make his fortune in the bakery business. He set up shop around government installations first. He did kind of figure out a good way to make money was to sell bread to army bases and things like that. He set up his very first one in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He was quite an entrepreneur. He effectively had franchises all across the country before that word was even in the lexicon. He had investors, silent partners, distribution centers, co-packing operations. I mean, we have one little bakery in the Marigny that is hard enough to keep going. You know, we do production and we do distribution. I couldn't imagine riding the train to do the end-of-the-month inventory. But if you fast forward a little bit, the Great Depression really took its toll on all of the Hubig's bakeries. We are the only one left that has the name Hubig's. They all failed for different reasons after Mr. Hubig's stopped participating in them and the Great Depression hit. And then World War II came and things that you need to run a bakery, dairy, eggs, milk, sugar, was rationed, even down to the petroleum to put in the delivery trucks and the rubber for the tires in the delivery trucks, and they all failed except ours.
Well, thank goodness.
Well,
where would New Orleans be without Hubig's? And everything's baked fresh right there.
Absolutely.
On Dauphine Street.
Absolutely.
Right?
We keep no inventory.
Wow. So what are the local ingredients that you use?
Well, the obvious ones, for example, we don't use things out of a can. If we have a sweet potato pie, we pluck the sweet potato, the jumbo yam, out of the field in the western half of the states. We deal with the farmers who have a co-op over there. We buy kiln-dried sweet potatoes that are grown in Louisiana. And when there's a particularly awful weather event and the field is too muddy to get them out, we might not be able to make sweet potatoes that day. If there's a drought, the season might be cut short. But we don't call up Sysco and order number 10 cans full of sweet potato pie filling and just dump them into the vat. We pull them out of the ground. We get them with dirt on them. We clean them and boil them and peel them and turn them into a sweet potato pie. I mean, there's a few obvious exceptions to that rule. When we say we make everything locally fresh, there are no pineapple plantations in southern Louisiana. You know, if you want a pineapple pie, it is not a Louisiana pineapple.
Right.
But, you know, it's made fresh locally, asterisk, you know, whenever at all possible.
Well, the fact that it's not coming out of a can, which I think nowadays a lot of people would assume, you know, Give me a for instance. What's the production like on those little hand pies? How many of them a day, a month, a year?
Well, it varies by day of the week and week of the month and season. There are certain days that we just simply know we're not going to do well. We don't compete so well against free. When the Easter Bunny candy is out, our impulsory snack item perhaps suffers a little bit. When the Halloween candy is out, we don't have very good sales. But there are other times that we do very well. It's kind of funny. When there's a storm in the Gulf, people run to the hardware store and people run to the store, and I guess they view us as comfort food, and we do very well when the threat of the hurricane is upon us. But if I had to give you an average, it would be somewhere between 25,000 and 35,000 pies a day.
A day. Holy moly. So can people in other parts of the country get Hubig's pies?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we do ship boxes and boxes of love every week. We will hopefully satisfy our expatriated New Orleans friends. We didn't up until Katrina. That was one of the very few good things that came out of Katrina. The dinosaurs that run our company had not a very complicated business model. It worked. You know, we buy fresh local produce, do a value-added service, you know, cook it, sell it for a reasonable profit, and put that money back into our employees and our local economy and go on to tomorrow's production. We lost all of our base. You know, we lost the customers, we lost the stores, we lost the ability to get the product there. And I don't mean to be a cheerleader for, but I wouldn't mind giving a plug for the Idea Village. The Idea Village came to us and said, we would like to give you a grant. We would like to sponsor a grant for you to do something entrepreneurial. You have to think outside the box, and we're going to give you this money, and you have to do something new and different. We built a website. We bought some T-shirts. The very first commerce in which we engaged post-Katrina was you could buy a T-shirt. You could buy a Hubig's Pie T-shirt online. When we finally got back into business in 2006, we had a specially designed box, and you could buy pies, and we could ship them all over the place, anywhere in the continental United States.
Drew, everybody who lived in New Orleans in August of 2005 has their own hurricane story to tell. And I was wondering, would you tell us the Hubig's Pie Katrina tale?
Well, I don't know if there is one Hubig's Pie Katrina tale, but I will tell you that if it could have gone wrong, it did go wrong for us. You know, our building, our actual bakery, suffered. The roof opened up. We actually lost some employees. But we make our pies the day before we deliver them, and our delivery day starts at about 3 a.m. So we have to anticipate what the market's needs are going to be for Monday morning, example. We cook on Sunday so that we have pies to go out at 3 a.m. on Monday morning. And if we bailed every time they said there might be bad weather tomorrow, we would have missed a great many sales days. We did make pies that Sunday. We were making production.
And Sunday, August the 28th.
Correct.
We were making pies.
Yes. And Katrina was obviously worse than we thought it was going to be. And we had the pies on hand, which we still needed. If there was a mild flood or if there was an electrical failure and we had lost, say, Monday, when the stores opened up on Tuesday, we wouldn't have had product to carry to the stores. Our pies have a one-week shelf life. We don't like to make them on Sunday and sell them on Tuesday. As a matter of fact, we never do that. But we needed to have them ready for when the market opened. Nonetheless, it got terrible. We didn't have anything to do with these pies. So we just opened up the bay doors, and we gave all the employees keys to the trucks, and we just loaded up the trucks, and we just drove around and gave out the pies. We went to the Superdome. We went to the convention center. We went to Causeway and the I-10 where people were waiting for buses, and we just gave away as many as we could. I mean, people were hungry, and we had food. It wasn't a hard decision to make. But the funny thing, I think it's funny, is we gave away pies to people, and at least one told me personally, but I heard the story from other employees, that there were other people who said, I was here for whatever. I was here for Betsy. And the first thing I had after Betsy was a pie. I was at the YMCA at Lee Circle, and the pie truck came down the street and was giving out pies because my grandfather had to make the same exact decision. And when it looked like it wasn't going to get it to the market, he wanted to give it to people.
But what you did that day, you didn't just give away the pies. What else did you give away?
Oh, we gave away the farm. I mean, we gave away. we gave the trucks to our employees. Our employees that could not get themselves and or their families out, we let them take the pie truck. You know, it's funny now. You know, it's funny now. But the conversation of the building is damaged and the production day's run has been given away and the vans have been driven away to we don't know where by people who we hope to see again. And so, yeah, that was, you know, when you're talking to your insurance agent, that's also an interesting situation.
But now, luckily, from the perspective where we're sitting here today, it all turned out fine.
Oh, it turned out wonderfully.
So
we probably
would
do it
again. How'd you get it back together?
Well, we got into a lot of chicken and egg arguments with our insurance company. We were properly insured, and we had what we thought was a legitimate claim. We'd been paying business interruption insurance for many, many, many years, generations, never made a claim. There were just a million things. I mean, I say chicken and egg, and it was one of those situations where if you're food service, you're supposed to have a sealed building. If you have a compromised building, then it can void your permit. You cannot get business interruption for a permit violation. You know, you can't have the health guy come in and fail you on an inspection, and then you turn around and call your insurance company and say, I'm out of business because I had a rat or something. So you need to have a functioning facility. Well, technically we didn't because the roof was in it, and we got into these, well, you're not allowed to be in business. Well, of course we're not allowed to be in business. There's a hole in the roof, which means we're interrupted. And like, well, you wouldn't be interrupted if you didn't have a hole in the roof. And there was many a hand-wringing issue. But we got back into business. All of our employees that we offered a job to who could come back to New Orleans came back. And we started to make pies.
And when was that? When did you get back into the pie business?
January of 2006.
There were a lot of happy people, I bet.
That was a fun time. We just made the pies, and we didn't really know even where we could sell them. A lot of the stores that we sold to previously had not come back into business. We were kind of reinventing the wheel. But we made them, and, you know, just because we're Hubigs, we actually gave away the first batch. If I don't know if you knew that part of the story, but we made a batch of pies and just gave them away.
Just gave them away. And, oh, my goodness, it must have been...
We gave them to fire... We gave them to the fire department, the police department, the EMS people. There was still the National Guard in town. We took them to those people. We gave them to people at the hospitals. Anybody who thought they looked worthy, we just gave them a pie. What else can you do?
Well, I am so grateful that you took the time to come and visit with us at Louisiana Eats.
Well, I truly enjoy being here. Sorry I kind of lost it there. It made me think of my former employees who are no longer with us, but God bless them.
Well, I want to thank you. Thanks so much for coming. Drew Ramsey of New Orleans' favorite Hubig's Pies. Return from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Hubig's Pies' Drew Ramsey and learn his company's plans for the future. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Previously, Drew Ramsey told us the story of rebuilding Hubig's following Hurricane Katrina. And now, back to our conversation with Drew Ramsey of Hubig's Pies. On Friday, July 27th, the Hubig's Pie Bakery burned to the ground in a tragic early morning fire. Drew Ramsey's here with details of what happened and what's going to happen next. Drew, thanks for coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Our pleasure.
You arrived on the scene pretty early that morning.
Yes, I was called by our nighttime receiving guy who was there, and I got there and watched the fire and the firemen before all of the fire trucks had arrived. You know, as I think most people know, it started to engulf the building and it started to get worse, and they called in more troops and more support. I don't have the final figures, but I know that there were a lot of fire trucks and a lot of firemen by the time it all got brought under control. And they did a really good job. We're really happy that they were able to contain it. You know, we suffered a complete and total loss, but our neighbors, I certainly don't want to say didn't suffer at all. I mean, there's blistered paint. There's some water damage from the amount of water that they were squirting over people's houses and bounced off of ours, but nobody's life was in danger. There's no fatalities. There's no injuries. And the neighbor's property that was damaged is fixable. So
that's really a great blessing, considering what an enormous fire that was. And have you all figured out yet how did the fire get started?
All indicators are that it started in a cooker that we were set to clean on Friday. Now, anything I tell you after that is speculation. And with a fire this size, there is an investigation, and they are currently investigating it. So I'm very reluctant to tell you what I think because they're looking at it. I mean, it was big, and it was quite awesome.
Well, there was no one hurt, but there were people in the building?
Yeah, we don't have quite a 24-hour operation, but we have almost a 24-hour operation. And the production run for Friday sales day, we make the product all day Thursday. We cook the filling. We cook the pies. We ice them. We cool them. We wrap them. We put the orders up. And we clean up. And then there's a little bit of downtime until the nighttime receiving guy that we previously spoke of comes in and turns off the alarm and counts the orders and such. And he had done that at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And there was actually a handful of our trucks, our delivery men, that had made it in, loaded up their orders, and headed out on their routes. There were some fresh pies delivered Friday morning. It is my understanding that they didn't make it very far into their routes. You know, the customers from the day before had paged the guys and said, "We're out of pies." People stopped them in parking lots and bought whole trays of pies from them. There wasn't a whole lot of pies to be purchased at the end of the day. Once the news spread, the pie was a hot commodity? You're smiling.
Well, it certainly is even more of a Louisiana icon than it ever was before. Some of the equipment appeared to be original and specially tooled for the bakery's needs.
It was. I don't know if the word proprietary would be accurate, but we had equipment that did exactly what we needed it to do, and we think that it did it well. Change comes to us very slowly. We weren't in the mood to make a new and improved or a better turnover. So, yes, our equipment was old, very old.
When did it date back to approximately?
Oh, Bobby, I couldn't tell you. So that I don't exaggerate, I'll say only 50 years. But those were the
okay.
That was the machine itself. But obviously, power transmission equipment, drives, shafts, motors, bearings, conveyors, I mean, everything that makes it up had been modernized. You know, there's food and drug inspections. The original conveyor belts were certainly not what the industry standard is today. And we had, you know, we were a functioning licensed bakery. So the machine was old, but it had been maintained. Nonetheless, one of the things that I like to remember is our little pie forming machine.
That's what I saw the picture of. It looked so cool.
There was a cutting head on that. It was a wheel, and it would cut out the pies. So that I don't exaggerate, I'll say that we only had that for 75 years. I mean, that thing has been making pies that way for generations now, and we still get people come up to me, you know, oh, they were bigger when I was a kid. And bless their heart, you know.
It's impossible.
Your dad was probably stronger. Your backyard was bigger, you know.
And you were littler when you were
littler.
A kid.
Yeah.
So how do you recreate this?
Well, Poppy, that's kind of the
that's
the
question. Conundrum, huh? Because
we are doing everything we can right now to recreate this, and there has been a lot of really kind and generous offers. And if anybody made one of those kind and generous offers, and I haven't responded to it, forgive me. I've been inundated, but we are getting to everything.
Would you tell us what has Rouse's Market stepped up to do?
Hubig's and Rouse's have a wonderful relationship. We do food in southern Louisiana, but we also go together as, you know, hand in glove. We enjoy a very symbiotic relationship with them. And they called immediately and offered what they could offer. And I'm working off the top of my head, but I think we're going to try and leave our racks, our shelf space, up in Rouse's. We're thinking about some sort of merchandise. They've offered assistance with our employees. Different Rouse locations have offered to take one of my employees and accept the application if that person is going to be temporarily unemployed. They've truly been wonderful, and they've offered everything I think they could offer, and it's wonderful.
Drew, when do you think we might be able to eat a Hubig's pie again?
The answer is as soon as possible. I have no idea. I truly have no idea. There are issues relative to excavating and demoing the historic building. Then we have to submit plans to rebuild. They have to approve them. And then we have to get a design build company in to do it. And we have to start to acquire all of the manufacturing and cooking and icing and cooling and wrapping machinery. And the simple answer to your question is I don't know.
Well, will you stay in touch and keep us posted?
I will, but I will also tell you that some of the kind and generous offers from the people who are younger than I am, who seem to know the world of tweet and Facebook much better, I will commit to everybody who can hear me. We're going to do a much better job staying in front of social media, and we're going to give people updates, and we're going to – people have asked, how can I support you? And people wanted to pre-order pies, but we as a company really don't like to promise – what's beyond our control. So we probably aren't going to offer a pre-ordered pie, but we are going to offer, you can certainly always buy a t-shirt. The t-shirt sales are real, and that's real support. And we're going to have probably some other merchandise. Anything I tell you right now would be a speculation.
Right.
There's a million ideas, but it could range from just a little bumper sticker. What do you think about this idea? You know how you peel the little sticker off the back of the bumper sticker?
Yes.
What do you think if the actual little piece of paper that you peeled off the back of the bumper sticker to stick on your car that said you support Hubig's was a little coupon that you got given the first order of pies when we did it? Or
you could sell that bumper sticker for a lot of money.
I just thought of that. What do you think?
I mean, that's a good one. I love it.
All right.
Now, last question for you. I understand your company has a new motto.
Get them while they're hot? What? I don't know.
Get them while they're hot. No. Rebuild.
Restore. Rehubigs.
Rehubigs.
We will not lose our flavor.
Well, I'm not going to lose my taste for them, and the whole world is waiting, so.
Well, please let everybody know how much we appreciate the outpouring of support. I didn't come to hawk my wares, but if anybody is curious, they can visit us on Facebook. We're tweeting. We, of course, have our website. There's a storefront on it. You can buy a t-shirt. You can buy a bumper sticker that'll support us. A couple local, of course, organizations have offered to do something very similar. The Dirty Coast guys, who are great, have made a T-shirt with the proceeds coming to our employees. The Flirty Girl has made a T-shirt, and the proceeds are going to come towards our employees. So there's little things that you can do, but the greatest thing you can do is not forget about us. And when we get back in business, buy a pie.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Drew. Drew Ramsey of the historic bakery, Hubig's Pies. Linda Green's famous Yakiman has been a staple in barrooms and on street corners where second lines start and end. Also known as Old Sober, this spicy soup will set you right no matter what you've been imbibing or what might be ailing you. I sweet-talked Linda's recipe out of her so that you can make the real deal at home whenever the need arises. First, boil a 2 or 3 pound beef brisket or chuck roast in unseasoned water for at least an hour until it's fork tender. While that's cooking, boil up a pound of number 4 spaghetti and hard boil, then peel a half dozen eggs. Thinly slice a couple of bunches of green onions and put everything aside while you chop up the beef. What Linda calls the juice starts with the water the beef was boiled in. Strain off any fat and add some Old Bay seasoning, granulated garlic, onion powder, parsley flakes, paprika, salt and pepper, some soy sauce, and then strengthen the broth with some beef soup base. Bring the liquid to a boil and cook until it tastes good. When you're ready to serve your Yakiman, put some spaghetti on the bottom of the bowl, put the chopped meat on top, sprinkle on the green onions, and ladle on the juice. Half a hard-boiled egg with the bright yellow yolk topside finishes your Yakiman off right. For a copy of Linda's recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Linda Green's Yakiman is real Louisiana Eats. And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the other name for Linda Green's famous second-line dish, the soupy hangover cure Yakiman, is Old Sober, which is said to be just the thing to sober you up for the trip home or cure what ails you the day after. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
This week our winner hails from the Big Farm in St. Tammany Parish. No, I'm not referring to a prison, but the city of Mandeville. Home of the largest certified live oak tree in the South, and even the site of a mental health facility that hosted Louisiana Governor Earl Long in 1959. So congratulations to Roxanne Newman of Mandeville for winning our prize, and thanks to everyone out there who participated. We hope you'll join in the fun this coming week.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of the prestigious journalism fellowship that will take food writer Brett Anderson to Harvard University this fall? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, What is the name of the prestigious journalism fellowship that will take food writer Brett Anderson to Harvard University this fall? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Public radio contributor and freelance journalist Ian McNulty is the author of Louisiana Rambles, an off-the-beaten-path exploration of our state's heartland. As Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Ian shares with us his latest discoveries. Okay, Ian, where have you been rambling to now?
Well, Poppy, recently got back from a trip that took me through part of South Arkansas back into Louisiana through the very north of Louisiana there. And let me tell you, you drive across some of that South Arkansas area, you get a little hungry, gets a little arid out there too, you know, and you cross over into Louisiana. And boy, the distinction is subtle, but you can really tell when you're back home in Louisiana. You cross over that border and suddenly you see Lake Providence and the cypress trees are coming out of the water. And right there you see a sign right after it says, "Welcome to Lake Providence." It says, "The Dock, just ahead." You know, it's advertising this restaurant called The Dock. And right below it, though, is a sign that's very familiar from highways all across the country. Subway for the sandwich chain, right? So there's The Dock and then Subway, the sandwich chain sign right underneath it. Well, you follow this to its logical conclusion, to this little restaurant, and it looks like an old Subway franchise, which is exactly what it used to be until the owners stopped being a Subway franchise, but somehow kept all of the signage and equipment and just started making fried seafood, boiled seafood, pulled pork. So now instead of going through and ordering your turkey sub, you're getting yourself a pulled pork po' boy a la Lake Providence.
So it's counter ordering, like you'd go through the Subway line?
Right. Yeah. You walk right up and, you know, they've done it over with beer coolers and hot sauce racks and, you know, things like this. And you go through and you order your sandwich or your platter of boiled crawfish. You can get yourself a bucket of beers. And then, unlike probably any Subway anywhere, you can then take all that out back where there is the namesake dock for this place, which is beautiful. Sit outside there under the shade of a cypress tree and eat your lunch or your dinner while people are boating past. And you see kids out there chucking, like, you know, the ends of French fries down to snapping turtles or circling around just below the dock. It's a really nice scene. And especially if you've been driving for a while, you're glad to be back in Louisiana. A stop at somewhere like this really hits the spot.
Are there boats at the dock? Can you motor up if you want to?
Absolutely, yeah. This is one of those places where, you know, you'll see people out, you know, day cruisers around Lake Providence doing some fishing or some water skiing off the back. They cruise on over, tie up. The kids go running inside to get some candy. The adults saunter in right behind them. 20 minutes later, boom, off they go again to the next boating adventure.
Is it lunch and dinner?
Yeah, lunch and dinner, yeah. And it's right there on that main road coming through Lake Providence. Pretty hard to miss. Kind of seems like a first-stop hub right there when you're coming through.
Well, Ian, that really sounds like my kind of Louisiana Eats. There's nothing I love like boiled crab.
Yeah, it's a really nice find. And, you know, just got that weird little twist of having been this national franchise that just shot right back to its Louisiana roots. And, boy, is it a lot better for it.
Well, thank you so much for this next hot tip. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Poppy. It was a pleasure. I'll be rambling.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Ian McNulty. Coming up after the break, Memphis natives Paul and Angela Knippel, authors of The World in a Skillet, explore how the South's immigrant culinary culture is expanding the definition of Southern food. Poppy Tooker, and on this week's Louisiana Eats, Paul and Angela Knippel, authors of The World in a Skillet, take us along on a food lover's tour of the new American South. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Husband and wife writing team Paul and Angela Knippel believe that you can discover the whole world in a southern black iron skillet. Interviewing more than 40 first-generation immigrants who now call the South home, they're here to invite us along on an international culinary journey that never crosses north of the Mason-Dixon line. Paul and Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Poppy.
So how did you all come to write this book?
There's a wonderful Mexican restaurant in Germantown, which is a suburb of Memphis. And the owner, when the business first opened, before it got so crazy busy, if he didn't recognize a customer, he would ask, have you eaten with us before? And if they said no, they would not eat there until they heard his story. And he serves very traditional Mexico City-style street food, no Tex-Mex, you know, no refried beans, no sour cream. And he also told them about why the quality of the food is so important and why they shop every single day for fresh produce. First time we went there, we heard the story. Eating there afterwards, we heard other people hear the story many times. One day, we just heard someone get asked that question, and we looked at each other and said, we should write a book about this.
Well, what was it like working as a husband and wife writing team?
That's really been great. We pass ideas back and forth, and seeing things from a different perspective helps. You know, we would hear these immigrant stories, and usually one of us would say, this is how I want to tell this story. And then we would pass it back and forth until we really had this unified voice telling the story.
When it came down to actually writing the book, what was the work division like?
For writing the essay-type portions, it really was whoever was inspired by someone to start it. We both have slightly different styles. Angela has a very lyrical, sort of free-flowing style, and I have a little more structured, technical writing kind of style. And again, we would just, whoever was inspired would put it down and give it to the other. And if I wrote something, Angela would usually, you know, file down my rough edges or, you know, my sharp corners, and I would, you know, put a little structure to her poetry, and it kind of comes into a unified voice. Then, of course, there's the matter of the recipes, and that's where Angela is the genius.
When it was all over, the whole thing, the first thing our son said was, can we eat normal food now, please?
Now tell me, what are the countries represented in World in a Skillet, and which states did you cover?
We covered everything that would be considered the South. We didn't make it to Texas or Florida because they're just so large and their cultures are so great. They're books in and of themselves. We did the coast, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Arkansas.
I'm curious, which southern city did you find to be the most international?
Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Atlanta was very hard to narrow down. Of course, one of the things we really had to do was make sure we weren't making a favorite of any particular city, that the book wasn't going to be overpopulated by any one city. And Atlanta was very hard to narrow down because there's this one strip called Buford Highway in Atlanta. And on that one highway, you find this huge international representation. And it's not like anywhere else that I've ever seen. Normally, immigrants cluster, and you'll have a Vietnamese area or a Chinese area or an African area. But on Buford Highway, you'll see an Ethiopian restaurant next to a Korean restaurant, next to a Chinese restaurant, next to a Mexican restaurant, next to a deli from the Middle East. And they're all right there together on this miles-long stretch of highway. And it's just amazing. It's a fun, fun place to go.
Well, I know several of your contributors can be found right here in New Orleans. Let's talk about them.
Yes.
New Orleans was our second biggest city that we had the problem with trying to narrow down. We talked to two gentlemen from Central and South America. One is Manny Ochoa Galvez, who owns Macarena Pupuseria, which is very close to Camellia Grill, right around the corner.
Yeah.
Wonderful place. Wonderful man. He's just got such a tremendous personality. We also talked to Edgar Caro, who owns Baru Bistro on Magazine. And the key word for both of them was grandma, because Manny talked about his grandma, who is still living in El Salvador, and she still gathers ingredients, you know, dries them, makes their spices, grinds them, and ships them here. And Edgar's grandmother lives here, but, you know, as he was learning to cook as a younger man, and even now in the restaurant, he says, if my grandmother doesn't complain, I know I've done it right.
And one of the things that we really looked at, too, with the book is we wanted to talk to people that anyone else would want to sit down and have dinner with. And Father Vian, you could sit down and talk to him all day and never get bored.
True. He was the pastor at Mary Queen of Vietnam, and he's still here working in the Archdiocese.
Yes. Yes. He just has such amazing goals for his community and what he wants to see happen here. And just hearing his story about how the community pulled back together after Katrina and what they did to work together and make it just a wonderful community was just amazing for us.
How is the South's immigrant culinary culture expanding the definition of Southern food?
It's so great. Maria Macreso in Bardstown, Kentucky, is a Bosnian refugee. And one thing that's really great is seeing Southern cuisine influencing her, because the best derby pie in town is made by this Bosnian refugee. She owned a restaurant in Bosnia and, of course, had to flee and come here. But now she's being influenced by the South. But we've also seen influences going the other way.
Catfish sushi.
Catfish sushi.
Yes.
I haven't seen that.
A place called Little Tokyo in Ridgeland, Mississippi. Their original location was in downtown Jackson. I think it's still there.
Yep.
When they first moved there, they were the first Japanese restaurant to open in Jackson, Mississippi. And one of the things they served to try to get people who'd never tried sushi before was fried catfish wrapped in a sushi roll.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And instead of soy, of course, you can also have the soy, but instead of soy, it also comes with a small little bowl of comeback sauce, which, you know, is the remoulade of Jackson, Mississippi.
Were there any dishes thought of as Southern classics that you all found out to have surprisingly immigrant roots?
I'm not sure that there are any Southern classics that aren't immigrant dishes, because everything in Louisiana, you know, there's the wonderful French influence and the Spanish influence, and everything from that we think of in our, you know, Tennessee, Mississippi background of greens and okra is all, you know, influenced by African Americans.
Well, did you see any cases of surprising substitutions that immigrants were making for things that they couldn't source?
Not really. I mean, I think that's one thing that the South has really opened up with commerce. You find international markets in almost every major city. People are able to bring in things that they couldn't before. And then just like here in New Orleans, you see immigrants growing gardens, like the Vietnamese community has their huge gardens where they're growing their own produce. So we really don't see that many ingredient substitutions because people are able to get most of what they need.
Or they'll grow it themselves,
exactly.
I guess.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, the South has had a reputation of being reluctant to change. And it also has Southern hospitality going on. So how did you all see that factor into the immigrant experience?
I don't think we talked to a single person who said they felt unwelcome. We did have a couple of people who worried when we first started talking to them that we might be from immigration.
Oh.
We had to reassure them that, no, we're not from immigration. We just want to talk to you. But no one ever said they felt unwelcome in their community.
The most difficult thing, though, was for some of the Muslim immigrants. One of the gentlemen from our Kurdish chapter, Rauf Ari, was an electrician in Iraq. Of course, fled Iraq, you know, during the war, and came here. Was working here as an electrician in Nashville. And after 9/11, you know, everyone in his company knew he was a Muslim, and everyone started putting a lot of pressure on him. You know, why did this happen? You know Osama bin Laden. Why, you know, a lot of ridiculous prejudice that he did face. So he went to his management and said, you know, I can't take this. Can you please just lay me off? I'm going to move on. So he invested in a grocery store, a small market, and has made a big success out of that.
Well, I just want to thank you all so much for telling us all of these beautiful tales of humanity and the wonderful way you stirred it together in that skillet. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Poppy.
Paul and Angela Knippel, co-authors of The World in a Skillet. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. One of the most prized products to come from our state's waters is the soft-shell crab. Our Bayou des Amens hero explains the process she goes through to catch those crabs at just the right moment.
A soft-shell crab is a crab that has molted because it wants to grow larger. And we don't catch them soft. That's the trick. The fishermen can identify the crab in the crab trap by certain signs. And one of the signs on the male and female are the swimmer fin of the crab. You can look and you can see an outline of either white, pink, or red. And those signs will tell you how far away the crab is from shedding.
You can find this week's hero, Jeannie Fonseca, at the Red Stick, German Coast, and Crescent City Farmers Markets, selling her live soft-shell crabs, fat, juicy, and ready for the pan.
So once the crab starts to shed, it cracks right on the back. The back opens up, and the crab slowly wiggles out. Depending on the water temperature, if it's really warm, it's a faster process. And it really takes a lot of energy for these crabs to back out of their shells, especially the larger ones, because they've done it a few times. And once they're out of their shells, it's beautiful to see. It's just like being born again. And once they wiggle out, they're in a very weak stage. You want to let them sit maybe about an hour and just let them kind of get a little firmer. And when you see those peaks straightening out, then you remove them from the tank, and we will place them in trays and then refrigerate them and just keep like a moist paper towels or towels on top just to keep them moist and fresh.
Congratulations, Jeannie. You're our Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero of the Week, recognized with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchens. I'm Poppy Tooker, and soft-shell crabs from Jeannie Fonseca are real Louisiana eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, author John T. Edge gives us an intimate look at the food truck scene that's sweeping the nation.
What I found going back around, touring for this, revisiting cities like Minneapolis, which had a kind of a nascent street food scene when I was there, and now it's blossomed. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I didn't even travel in the book, but now when I went back there a few weeks ago, there's this really great, vital scene with great banh mi vendors and great pork schnitzel vendors and the like. I think Americans will embrace the idea of eating good food fast.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House.
Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cooking Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to Thomas Walsh, our associate producer and sound engineer. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.